It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest makes the case for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, despite the scrutiny it's been getting in recent months.
First, 'tis the season to be spooky and read spooky stuff. Days are shorter, the wind's picking up, so it's the right time to curl up with a Halloween read.
To help us out, we've got super reader Anne Strainchamps with us. She's the host of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and she's always surrounded by piles of books.
Yeah, whenever I need a good book recommendation, I go to Anne. And this week, she rounded up some great new reads for the spooky season. Anne, welcome back.
Hey, nice to be here, you guys.
So why do you think Halloween is such a great time to read?
Well, you just said it. It's getting dark. You don't want to go outside. It's cold. And you really want to curl up with a book that's going to be a page-turner, just completely take you away. Plus, books are magical to begin with, don't you think?
I do think that. But I have to say, for Halloween, I'm a bit of a chicken. So I will read things that are not very scary, maybe mildly intriguing. How would you rate the books you've got for us today? Are they on the scary level?
I would say the first two are not especially scary at all, and the third one, you probably don't want to read them.
Okay, thanks for the warning. Well, let's start off with the first one you got for us. It's a book called Ash and Bramble.
Right. So this is by Sarah Pinius, and it's a young adult page-turner. I am one of those adults who reads young adult books, and this is a Midwestern Iowa writer. This is a totally original take on a fractured fairy tale. There's an evil sorceress. She kidnaps people, wipes their memories, and makes them act out the plots of fairy tales in real life. So in this one, there's a glass slipper, a magic godmother, a ball gown, a prince, but it's all a lot darker and more sinister than I'm sure you can name this fairy tale, right?
Sounds like Cinderella.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And yet not.
So a little bit darker, which seems to be the trend with young adult fiction these days. Another thing that's a huge trend with young adult fiction is sort of the warrior, the avenging female character. Is that in this trope, or is this a little different?
This one's a little bit different. She's not, you know, Katniss Everdeen or whatever. She's not a big warrior with sword, but she is a very strong female character in control and power of empowered to take charge of her own life. And that's really what the book is about. It's about her becoming gradually more empowered. So when you meet her at the beginning, she's kind of just waking up and she has no idea who she is or where she is. And it turns out she's in this godmother, who's not a good godmother, terrible stone prison. And she's part of a group of enslaved seamstresses who spend all their days sewing ball gowns for use in fairy tales. And little by little, she kind of recovers her memories and she meets a handsome young shoemaker. And together they sneak out of the castle and into the woods. And they wind up getting away, but then she wanders into town. She meets three people who seem to know her. Her stepmother and two stepsisters. And that's when things get even darker and she begins to figure out that she's trapped in a fairy tale.
So is this a feminist retelling of Cinderella?
Yeah, I would say so, because what happens is the evil godmother traps everybody in quote-unquote story. And story is kind of a dark force that is shaping people's lives. So she's been given a good story, right? The fairy godmother wants her to be the new Cinderella. So there's a charming prince and there's a ball gown and there's a clock and glass slippers waiting for her, but she doesn't want the made-up fairy tale ending. She wants to be in charge of her own destiny and make up her own life. So I absolutely see it as a feminist fairy tale in the sense that she's suggesting we all resist the scripts that we've been handed and make up our own.
Interesting. Yeah, that sounds like one that I could read. So your next one might be a little bit darker still. This one is not YA, right? Your next one?
No, the next one is not YA.
And it's called Rules for Werewolves. Tell us a little bit more about that one.
By Kirk Lynn. And this is a completely different kind of book. This one is very funny. It's by an experimental player, pretty well-known playwright who based in Austin, Texas. And as you might expect from a playwright, the book is written entirely in dialogue. And it's the story of a group of runaways and misfits in their teens and early 20s who roam suburbia, squatting in empty houses, and they consider themselves a pack and believe that they're werewolves. And so here, just to give you a taste of it, this is an excerpt from chapter one. Susan tells Bobbert how to become part of the pack.
Hey, it's cool. I'm not going to hurt you. I just want to let you know you can't sleep there. Why not? It's going to get cold tonight. I'll be all right. You're in the parking lot, huddled up between a dumpster and the walls of a speedy stop, without a roof. I'm trying. Why don't you come with me? Why? Where are we going to go? I have some friends. They have a house. Not a house they own, but just a place where we can stay. There's about 20 of us sleeping there, maybe. Look, it's not legal. They don't own the house, but it's warm. You just have to go along with what they say. Like what? It's weirder than I can really explain, but you're going to like these guys. It's like a family. Everybody's sleeping in the same living room, watching out for one another. It's safe. And it's warm. And it's all ours until somebody finds out.
All right, well, that sounds like an okay setup there, hanging out in a nice warm house with a bunch of friendly people. What's the catch, Anne?
Who may or may not be werewolves. Actually the catch is you don't really know whether they're just pretending to be werewolves and this is like a, you know, group thing, make-believe thing, or whether they actually are literally werewolves. And I did an interview with the author, that was Kirk Lynn Reading, and he and his editor actually disagree on whether they're literal or metaphorical werewolves. As he says, well, I wrote it, so you're wrong.
But seems fair.
There's this great backstory, too. Kirk says that he got the idea for squatting in houses because when he was a junior and senior in high school growing up in San Antonio, Texas, and when he would drive through neighborhoods and see houses that were for sale or empty, he would get out of his car and go kind of peek in through windows, see if there was a way to get in. And then later he would go back, either with a date or with his buddies, to just drink some beer. He said they never defaced the property, did anything like that. They just kind of liked feeling like, oh, it's our space.
Wow. So he's done some real research for this. The other thing I like about this is that it's werewolves. I feel like I'm a little zombied out. I don't know about you, but I'm a little done with the zombie thing. I know everyone else, you know, loves them right now, but it's kind of cool to hear about another supernatural creature here, werewolves.
No, that's true. I can't think of any really great werewolf novels. I can think of some good werewolf movies, but and the zombie ones, to me, I feel you about zombies because I don't think anybody can write them without gore. And I'm just, you know, not into the whole dripping slime part.
We're talking to Anne Strainchamps right now. She's the host of Wisconsin Public Radio's To the Best of Our Knowledge. And she's got a few recommendations for great Halloween reads. And the one we just heard about there was called Rules for Werewolves. And we're going to wrap up with one from David Mitchell. And this one is called Slade House. What's the setup here?
Okay, David Mitchell, bestselling author of Cloud Atlas. People may remember it was short. Listed for the Booker. His other books have been doorstoppers. This is really short, and it's his take on a haunted house story. Basically, there's a house called Slade House. It's in the middle of London. There's something very creepy about it. Once you go in, you can't ever leave. Anthony Doerr calls it Hansel and Gretel for grown-ups, and it really is. It's kind of surreal, and it really is a creepy read.
So this is more genuinely creepy. Like, you don't want to read this at night when you're alone in the house.
I put it down after reading about half of it, but it's not Stephen King creepy. It's literary. It's absolutely beautifully written. But essentially, you know, it follows all these different characters and they're several short plots, but basically there's this creepy brother and sister who live in this old, old house. Every 9 years, they invite somebody new. And that's the only time when you can ever find the entrance to Slade House. And if you show up at the entrance and you can see it, they'll greet you by name and you'll go inside. And it seems to be much, much bigger inside than it was outside. And it's filled with wonderful things, gardens and plates of pastries and lots of gorgeous antique furniture. And then your nightmares start coming true. And that's the creepy part.
Okay. All right. So I like how you've got a spectrum of books there, from super scary to Veronica can probably read this. So Anne, before we let you go, any other favorite classic spooky reads that aren't on this newer list? Anyone that you turn back to over and over?
Okay. Well, so I'm the one that I love and that I reread often at Halloween time is not remotely spooky. I really love A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness.
Oh, yeah.
I think you know this, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm a sucker for a story that rewrites witches as not scary, but as powerful and beautiful. And so this is one. You know, it's about a Yale historian and a witch, Diana Bishop, and, you know, starts at Oxford University, and there's a magical enchanted manuscript and a really hunky vampire, and who's also a genetic biologist, so, you know, what's not to like?
We like it when our vampires are also genetic biologists.
Yeah, and he does yoga, too.
Nice. Well, Anne, thank you so much for stopping by and recommending some books for us.
My pleasure. Happy reading.
That was Anne Strainchamp. She is a super reader here at WPR and host of the station's show To the Best of Our Knowledge. She joined us to recommend some great new spooky reads for Halloween.
The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation has been the subject of some bad press in recent months, but according to our next guest, that shouldn't be a reason to get rid of it.
WEDA came under fire last month for giving out loans to companies that couldn't pay them back and to business owners who donated to Governor Walker's election campaigns. Research also found that while WEDA spent more money last year, the state saw fewer jobs from that investment.
Joining us now is Michael Eisenga, former mayor of Columbus and owner of American Lending Solutions and First American Properties. He recently wrote an op-ed titled, "Wisconsin Should Be Patient, Stick with WEDA." Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rob.
So in a nutshell, I mean, there's been some bad news, criticism now from both parties of WEDA. Why should we stick with it?
Well, I think every tool we have in our state to promote economic development is a tool we should look at trying to continue and trying to find ways to make it work.
At its best, forget the stuff that's happened so far. How should it work? What should we be seeing from WEDA?
Well, I think that any economic development tool that is put in place by the government or a county government, for example, I was involved for several years with the Columbia County Economic Development Corporation, which has many similarities to WEDA, which is at the state level. Obviously, we were at the county level. Really needs to be transparent, first of all, and we need to have a distinct set of guidelines of what we're looking for to accomplish and some strategies in place.
And that's been one of the criticisms, and you mentioned this in your piece, that there's such a rush to try to get results. You say that there wasn't that transparency, that there weren't those standards to begin with. Is that part of what went wrong from the outset?
Well, that's probably the case, and I think whenever you're trying to do something new we essentially stopped having the Department of Commerce and we transferred that into WEDA. Obviously, there's going to be some growing pains and there's going to be some things that are going to take place as you make some changes.
I want to get a little philosophical here. As I mentioned, both parties have criticized WEDA for one reason or another. A conservative objection to this sort of thing has been, hey, government shouldn't be in the business of picking winners, giving them loans or other types of support. Let the market sort those things out. How would you answer that critique?
Well, I think that there's some very good points to that, and it is important that we're not picking winners and losers. But I do think also there are certain areas, especially in our state, that really could benefit from some of the programs that WEDA offers. And, sometimes having a little bit of assistance from that standpoint with tax credits or even the loans that you're talking about, so long as they're done in a nonpartisan and transparent way, can help fulfill some gaps that maybe traditional lenders are not able or willing to make. Again, as long as they're done in a transparent way and we have some distinct guidelines and goals and what we're trying to accomplish when we're doing those things, whether they be on the state or the local level.
And maybe from a more liberal perspective, people have seen this as a way to use taxpayer money to support business, big and small, maybe groups allied with whoever happens to be in charge of the levers of power in government. How much should we worry about that?
Well, I think it's something that we should always, be keeping an eye on. Obviously, it's very important that is not how, programs like those are perceived. I think a better way to look at it is, I think whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, we all want to do everything we can. I mean, I tend to lean more the Republican way, but I also know a lot of people who are liberals and a lot of people who are Democrats, and I think we all agree that we really want to find ways to bring better jobs back to Wisconsin and grow our economy and continue to grow the middle class, because that's really where the jobs have been suffering. So to me, if we're looking at county level programs or state level programs, that's the place to start. How are we going to be competing with other states across the country in helping to bring companies that are going to bring those types of jobs to our state? Or how can we assist a company that's here right now who may have some growth plans to make sure that those growth plans are here and not in another state? Because we want to get those jobs here.
Talking to Michael Eisinger. He's former mayor of Columbus and a business owner. Talking about a recent piece he wrote about the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. It's gotten a lot of bad press for the way it's given out loans, for transparency, for accountability. He says, though, don't be too quick to get rid of it. Don't get rid of it, he says. Fix it. The state needs something like this. So how can we restore confidence now? Because, again, Democrats have criticized this. Republicans have criticized this. What would we need to change, maybe at a policy level, to make people say, okay, we trust where WEDC is going now?
Well, like I said earlier, I think that really one of the most important things is that we have some specific guidelines that we're looking at so that if you meet specific guidelines, those programs are available for you. Also, I know, recently there's been a change in leadership over there, and that's Mark Hogan has taken over. And, Mark Hogan has a pretty strong history of leadership. He was the chief credit officer at M&I Bank. And he has a background with the Better Business Bureau. I think he served on a board or two there. So I think that, sometimes in business, especially, I've gone through this, sometimes there are times when you need to look at who's leading an agency, and maybe there are some changes that need to be made at the top. And I think that some of that's been looked at and worked on. And I think that by finding great leadership and giving things a chance, that may be the direction to go. Again, I want to make sure that we have a state of Wisconsin that is in the game to try to create as many jobs here in our state, because there's lots of other states that are pushing all kinds of tax incentives and loans and things like that. And we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to build our state.
Are you worried, given the current legislature and what kind of scrutiny WEDC is getting, that it might be gotten rid of?
It's possible that they may decide to get rid of it. I mean, if they get rid of it, I hope that they look at all the different angles and all the different advantages and disadvantages and, make a weighted decision. Preferably, I think that we started down this road by making some changes at the Commerce Department level and, doing the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. So, we have new leadership in place. I have a lot of faith in that leadership. I like his background. He also ran WEDA for a while, and I think pretty much anybody around the state would probably agree. WEDA, from my perspective, has been very much a nonpartisan, department. And, I think that with the right leadership, we can make some strides.
And you mentioned similar programs at the county level in Columbia County. In your case, have we seen success stories from this kind of effort at that more local level?
Yeah, I really enjoyed being a member of the Columbia County Economic Development Corporation. I served as the vice president of that group for many, many years. And during that time, we would get referrals of businesses that were looking to locate into Wisconsin. And we had a staff there. We had a great staff that would help people put together business plans. They would help work on finding different programs that might be available, such as what WEDC offers now. And we were able to be very helpful in bringing an ethanol plant to Friesland. And there were a number of businesses that we worked with that expanded over that period of time and located in Columbia County.
Is there a priority area for economic development in the state that you think an organization like WEDC should be focusing on? Maybe a type of industry or a region or any priority that you think should be at the top of their agenda?
Well, I think the priority should be, we really need to take a look at the workforce that we have instead of trying to create a new industry that's going to attract a different workforce. And we have a great workforce here in Wisconsin. I own a company that has offices in different states, and I will tell you firsthand, the people here in Wisconsin have an unbelievable work ethic. And, I'm glad that I've lived here my whole life and that I built my businesses here. But I think what we want to do is we really want to look, and we can look at it region by region. I mean, we have a number of blue collar workers that we can be looking at, trying to find ways to bring businesses into the state that those folks can find some good paying jobs. And there's a lot of that. We can focus on trade type businesses, because you can never export the trades to China. We're always going to need plumbers. We're always going to need electricians. And those folks have to be here. So, you know, I think, and we can look at it regionally, because there are certain regions in our state that really have some needs, and they've had some larger businesses that have closed in the last few years that, you know, we can definitely benefit those areas.
Briefly, that's different than what a lot of people are saying. They're saying, let's go for higher tech, higher research, higher education types of jobs.
Well, I don't think that we take those off the table, but I think that if we're looking at a comprehensive plan, I mean, we certainly want to put the people we have here to work, and we want to look at what we can do to help bring jobs that those folks qualify for and build on those jobs, because the workers in Wisconsin have a great work ethic.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Eisinger making the case that we shouldn't get rid of Weedick, but give it more time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll ask you about how you're changing your diet or not after a new study shows processed meats come with an increased cancer risk.
First, we're checking in on what's happening today in the state assembly. Lawmakers are meeting and considering several bills.
One bill being discussed today would expand the ability to carry concealed knives. Another would begin the process of eliminating the state treasurer's office. And a third would overhaul the civil service system.
Sean Johnson is with us to talk about the proposed legislation. He's the state capitol reporter here at WPR News. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, let's start with the one that's gotten the most attention, the civil service overhaul. We've talked to you about this before, but sum it up for us. Briefly tell us what's going on in this change.
Yeah, basically, Republicans are making a lot of changes to the civil service protections in Wisconsin, and these are protections that go back to the days of, you know, fighting Bob La Follette. They've been around for more than a century, and while they have undergone changes over the years, this is a pretty big package full of changes. I think... Broadly speaking, you'd say that the plan that's up for a vote today in the assembly makes it easier or quicker to hire somebody, also makes it easier for a supervisor to fire somebody, and puts more of an emphasis, on that supervisor making decisions on hiring, firing based on what they see as merit. It's a little more subjective than the current system. Which is based on, taking an exam to get hired and seniority, things like that. Under the new system, the supervisors would have more authority to decide who's doing their job well and who isn't.
And what happened with this today in the assembly?
As you and I speak right now, it's under debate. As something, you know, like this usually goes, there are a lot of Democratic amendments to the bill. They're in the minority party. And so, I mean, all they can essentially do is call out what they see as the flaws with the bill that's going through the assembly. And so they're in the process of doing that right now. Probably be, maybe a couple more hours debate on this plan. Eventually, Republicans are going to pass it, and it's going to go to the Senate. But we don't know exactly what's going to happen there because the Senate and Assembly have some differing views on what this plan should include.
And as I understand it, one of the main differences is the idea of what people call the ban the box provision. First of all, what is this ban the box idea?
Yeah, the ban the box idea is that when you go back, I mean, people who support this say that you shouldn't have to, when you're applying for a job, check a box to say whether or not you have prior criminal convictions. And the thought is that people who have those convictions on their record, we want to get them back into the working world, and we don't want that those convictions, especially if they've served their time, to kind of hamper them as they, you know, as they try to get a job and better themselves. So that is ban the box. That is in the assembly bill that's going to pass today. That is not in the Senate bill that cleared committee already. And that's because Senator Steve Noss, who chairs the Senate Labor Committee, doesn't like it. He says, you know, even if you have this ban the box provision, it is something that could come up later in, a job search. There are some state jobs that require you don't have any kind of a criminal record. And so he wants to, he does not want that ban the box provision in there. So we'll see what happens. What I think what it does mean is that you know, a lot of the changes that Republicans have been proposing lately have been moving pretty quickly. It looked like this was one of them. It's going to slow down a little bit.
Apart from that difference among Republicans, the main argument back and forth seems to be Republican supporters say this makes it easier, as you said, Shonda, to hire and fire people. It makes the system more efficient, more like what happens in the private sector. Democrats saying it opens the door to cronyism and patronage, which the initial civil service laws a century ago were supposed to get rid of. Has that been the line of argument pretty much today in the assembly?
Yeah, that sums it up in a nutshell. I mean, the Republican refrain on this is that we've got to mirror the private sector, because if we don't, these people who might, the qualified people who might apply for state work or get hired into state work and go get hired into the private sector, Democrats are saying, well, hold on. First of all, government is not the private sector. Second of all, if you're worried about, you know, what state employees think about their jobs, you might want to look at the rest of your agenda over the past few years. And then, as you mentioned, they bring up this idea that under these changes, you are going to open the door to more political hiring in Wisconsin, particularly because, you know, the way that the hiring process is overseen, it'll just be a few appointees away from the governor. And the thinking is among Democrats, well, you know, it's just going to open the door to, I guess, packing state government with people who have, you know, worked on Republican campaigns potentially. Republicans say, you know, that's illegal. But I guess the Democratic counter to that is, yeah, you can do it with a wink and a nod and it'll happen.
Talking to WPR reporter Sean Johnson about the latest news from the state assembly today. That was the civil service. Now, every now and again, Sean, we go to the polls and elect a state treasurer, usually not the marquee race in any given election. That would change, though, under what the assembly is working on, eliminating the state treasurer's office. What's the reasoning behind that?
This is one of those bills where I think supporters say this is a tangible way that we can point to an area where we are cutting state government. You know, I think if you look at the dollars saved under cutting the state treasurer, I'm not sure that's even been figured up, but it is not expensive at this point. The treasurer's office has been whittled down so much over the years in terms of how much responsibility it holds that even if you get this passed, you're not going to save a lot of dollars. It is one of those concrete, tangible examples, though, of cutting government that Republicans like to point to. And at least in the assembly today, you had a handful of Democrats who sided with them and voted to end the state treasurer, although it's still got a ways to go.
And we saw both the current state treasurer and his predecessor run on the agenda item of getting rid of the job they were running for. So even the office holders there support that.
Yes. The previous state treasurer did start to sort of change his tune, though, while he was in office, just because he said that he saw the value of what the office did when it came to managing unclaimed property, for example. That duty was taken away from the treasurer's office. It's now, you know, under the Walker administration. So that's the basic point that Republicans are making here, is that we've taken away so much stuff from this job. All this person really has to do is be on a conference call for the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, pretty obscure state agency in itself, you know, just every few weeks. So they want to move this forward, and they think that the public will vote to eliminate this office if they get the chance. But first, it has to pass the Senate this session. That didn't happen last session, so it's not a guarantee. And then it also has to pass the full legislature again next session.
And that's all because this is a constitutionally defined job, so it would take a constitutional amendment to change it, right?
That is correct. So until all that happens, the state treasurer will continue reporting to duty in his not-so-fancy digs in the capital of the state basement, right across from the state's Secretary of State, by the way, who has also seen a lot of his duties removed. They're both in the basement together, although Republicans are not pushing to eliminate the Secretary of State.
And finally, we hear a lot about concealed carry of firearms. The Assembly working on concealed carry of knives today. What are lawmakers working on when it comes to knives in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's my understanding from just looking at the memo on this bill, we're not talking about just concealed carry of knives. We're talking about carrying knives. And this is a bill that started out as trying to kind of close a loophole on the way that our knife statutes are written as it is right now. If you have a spring-loaded knife, that could get you in trouble. So lawmakers kind of set out to fix that. What they ended up with was a bill that would ban the state's prohibition on switchblades. So if this becomes law, you can carry a switchblade in Wisconsin, and not just concealed. It would just say that you wouldn't be charged with a violation of disorderly conduct or anything like that for carrying or going armed with a knife. And we're reading here from the Legislative Reference Bureau memo, without regard to whether the knife is concealed or openly carried. So, and it would ban local governments from passing any kind of ordinance that is stricter than that. So it's a pretty big step forward in terms of what you're allowed to do with knives in Wisconsin. I think it's referred to probably accurately as constitutional carry for knives.
And I've seen some reaction from prosecutors and others saying, okay, it was okay if we clarify that you shouldn't be arrested for carrying your Tom Mix utility knife or your Swiss Army knife. This could open the door to, I don't know, carrying swords, machetes, long switchblades, Bowie knives, that sort of thing.
It could. I mean, I'm not sure about the swords and the Bowies just because I'm not familiar enough with the issue. But if you just look at the language of this bill that they pushed through, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of restrictions there on what you could carry. And the fact that you don't have to conceal it, you know, so you don't have to hide a sword under your vest or anything. You can it's talking about what you can carry out in the open. There's just not a lot there that says, no, don't do this.
All right, Sean, thanks as always for keeping us up to date.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, State Capitol reporter for WPR News. He was with us to talk about the bills that the State Assembly was considering today, including a bill that would overhaul the civil service system and the bill we were just talking about, expanding the ability to carry concealed or unconcealed knives.
Coming up, there's been a lot of media attention on a new report claiming a link between processed meats and the risk of cancer. We'll ask if the news will change your eating habits. You can call in starting right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Will the new study showing a link between processed meats and cancer change your diet, do you think? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
A report from the research arm of the World Health Organization got a lot of attention this week, pointing toward a possible health risk from the consumption of processed meat. Think things like bacon, sausage, a lot of kinds of lunch meat.
We'll get into more detail in a moment, but the gist, regular consumption of those meats, according to the report, leads to an increased risk of colorectal cancer. And the report points toward other kinds of cancer risks linked to processed meat and to red meat.
And we want to hear from you now. Will this news or this kind of news change the way that you shop and the way that you eat? Will you dial back on the bacon and sausage or maybe even red meat? Have you already done that? Or is this just not a big deal for you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
The report looked at 800 studies from around the world. The main conclusion, an 18% increase in colorectal cancer risk from eating the equivalent of 2 slices of bacon a day. Researchers point out that the risk of getting that disease is still low with or without the bacon. They're not saying we should stop eating these meats, but maybe dial it back a bit.
Looking for your calls at 800-642-1234. And Libya in Cudahy is with us. Hi.
Hi.
So what's your take on this?
Oh my gosh. Colon cancer is absolutely horrible. So I'm just going to cut all processed meats out of my diet.
So is this something that you've done already or maybe been dialing back on already? Or is this, are you turning on a dime here with this new study?
It's absolutely going to cut them off. Not worth it.
All right.
I was also a vegetarian for 6 years, so it'll be pretty easy.
Okay. You're not now, but you're going to maybe head back in that direction a little bit.
Yeah, might as well.
All right. Thanks a lot from Cudahy, too. That's a name often linked with processed meats. Thank you so much for getting us started, taking your calls. Does recent what appears to be bad news on processed meat. Is that going to change the way you eat? 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
And we're going to go next to Jerry, who's joining us in West Dallas. Jerry, hi.
Good afternoon. It's not going to change my habits at all. I'm going to continue to eat them. I just got done with a nutrition plan over the last year, which encouraged restricted carbohydrate and a lot of meat and pigs and things like that, and I lost 130 pounds in about 11 months, and my cholesterol hasn't changed at all. My blood sugar is fine, things like that, so I'm going to continue using this plan and doing the research, reading books about it, and it kind of refutes what this study says, actually. And I'm wondering if there isn't more of a relationship between, say, the bleached flour and things like that, and sugar that we might have, that maybe it has a reaction with when you use a lot of fatty meats. But
all right, well, interesting, Jerry. Appreciate your thoughts there. And I know that the low carbohydrate, high protein diets are still pretty much in vogue right now. A lot of people seeing effects. Congratulations on your weight loss. And it's an interesting thing, though, the meat versus not meat with this diet. Two slices of bacon a day was what we heard for an increased risk. That's not a lot of bacon.
Right. But also there's meat and then there's meat. There's the processed meats, which they define, the World Health Organization, these studies, salting, curing, fermentation, smoking, and other processes to enhance flavor or improve preservation. That leaves a lot of meat that doesn't have those things maybe
True.
As fair game. Thanks a lot for that call, Jerry. Next to another Jerry, and with us now in Birchwood. Jerry, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Jerry?
I cut back on a lot of processed meat, and I don't eat like lunch meat and so forth. And I've done that for a long time, but I always love bacon, and I will get rid of that too, because I don't eat a lot of red meat. I love my bacon, but if there's a risk of cancer, I don't want to eat it. So plain and simple, and whenever you get a health notice from WHO or any reputable health organization, I try to heat it. So
I hear you, Jerry. I mean, I've kind of switched bacon. I love it too. I've switched it to what Sesame Street calls a sometimes food. But you're not even going to go that far. You're saying bacon's out for you.
Bacon's out. Now I don't know about turkey bacon. That probably has the same. It's processed, so I'm sure that that probably isn't any good either. So.
All right, Jerry, thanks a lot for sharing your reaction, taking your reactions to this World Health Organization report. All over the news, a lot of reaction, sympathetic and angry, and all points in between. I want to know if it's going to change the way you think of processed meat. Apparently, some increased risk of some kinds of cancer. Is this going to change the way you shop and the way you eat? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go next to Ben joining us in Eau Claire. Ben, hello.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
Well, I think I've always known, I've visited a nutritionist before, and I've always known that fatty meats in general, are okay in moderation. But to hear that there's a study now, a vetted study that has kind of proven that it increases the risk of cancer, but the increased risk of cancer in most people, especially in my family, it just seems a no-brainer to cut it down to very, very rare. I'm not going to say I'm never going to have bacon. That's kind of a tall order, I think, probably for any Midwesterner. But the other side of this that kind of pains me is also to see how it might hurt the Wisconsin economy.
Oh, interesting
point.
Think
about a lot of different companies that are going to be relying on these things. And you think about states near us like Iowa, Illinois, big beef and pork-producing states. That's a hard thing to swallow.
And, Ben, before we let you go, do you expect that this change is going to be hard for you, or do you think it's not going to be so tough?
I don't think it's going to be very tough, because it's not something that I really purchase on a regular basis and make for myself. I think it'll be harder in the summer in terms of grilling, when I have friends over and I'm making breakfast. Kind of those specialty things when I'm out ordering breakfast, it's usually bacon in there. So I'll have to think about alternatives, but it's not like I eat bacon and sausage every single day of my life.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. It's interesting, the bacon conundrum here. Meat eaters on Twitter, some reacting with despair. We saw a comment from Stefan who tweeted, "I stopped smoking. I even stopped drinking. But you're going to have to take my bacon, my my beef, my hamburgers out of my cold dead hands.
And I have known people who say they're bacon-tarians, they're vegetarian. But if there's bacon at a gathering somebody else made, they'll give it up. That's
everything
the thing.
But bacon, vegetarian.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Yep.
Back to our callers now. Richard is with us in Elk Mound. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today? Hey, good show. Listen, everything in moderation, I think, is the way people ought to look at things. I come from a long line of bacon eaters. I was in the meat processing business for many, many years myself. My father was. My parents grew up on farms. They ate a lot of processed meats that they processed themselves. They lived into their 80s and older. I think it's a lot of a scare tactic. For what reason, I don't know. But do it in everything in moderation. I mean, my goodness, look at the scare on beer. A beer once in a while is fine. A cigar on occasion is fine. It's just when you make habits of these things and eat it all the time, anything can hurt you.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. And you agree with Chris, who posted on the Central Time Facebook page, simply one word with an exclamation point, moderation.
All right. Well, thanks for that. On to Stacy in Milwaukee. Stacy, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually became what's called a poultritarian about 17 years ago, and I've kind of continued on with that, where I only eat chicken, you know, meat, like chicken-type meat in moderation. I haven't had red meat in about that long, 17 years. So.
All right, so not a big deal for you, and you're probably feeling like this is not going to affect your life very much at this point. So.
No, I think it's interesting, though, because if you look at the category trends, I'm in the also in the grocery industry, and you kind of see there is a decline in the processed meat area overall. So I think it's interesting that people are starting to kind of take note that this isn't so great for you.
All right. Well, thank you, Stacy. An interesting perspective there from the grocery industry.
Adam in Gills Rock is with us next. Adam, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
Well, you know, the thing is that I agree with a couple of callers ago where you said, you know, everything in moderation. Too much of anything is a bad thing. But, you know, I'm going to continue to eat bacon and processed meat, but I'm not going to do it to the extreme. One thing that I was going to bring up, and I don't know if in the study they had mentioned this, but what about like home-raised meat versus store-bought meat? Is there any difference between that, how the livestock is raised? And I think that might be an interesting aspect to go off of, because I would also say that, you know, a lot of the meat that I eat is from it's from family. You know, they raise their own steers, or we'll buy a quarter pig, half pig, stuff like that from other farmers. I wonder if that has any bearing on the findings.
Interesting, Adam, and I know this study looked at 800 different studies around the world. I don't know if it got that fine-grained into the source of the meat, though. Thanks a lot for bringing that up, though. Interesting point, Adam.
And we want to thank you for your calls. Remember, you can keep this conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can just search Central Time on WPR.